Okay, welcome everybody. We're going to have our usual announcements, but one thing I want to let everybody know, I am at a workshop in Austin, Texas, and I will only be on the call for about 20 minutes today. But we have a presentation, and Scott Carley will facilitate the end of the call. So with that, I just want to first ask if there are any announcements. Well, I have a few things I can let people know about, and Karen, you, one of them is you're very much involved with the the NSF DRK-12 PI meeting. DRK-12 is Discovery Research K-12 PI meeting is at the end of this week, and Karen and I are facilitating a session looking at how environmentally relevant projects in the DRK-12 covers all of sciences and math, but we've identified the environmentally relevant projects, and we're having a session where we've had those projects, some of them mapping their projects to the climate literacy central principles and the environmental literacy components. And Karen can tell you more about that because I don't think that they've been described very well in this venue yet. So, Karen, you might actually have to give a talk on those at some point. And then having a discussion about how those two documents and the various projects intersect each other. And part of what I am hoping is that we can begin a special interest group within the DRK-12 program around these projects and bring that group into the climate literacy network to share what they're doing, and also potentially for the tri-agency climate change education group. So that's going to be at the end of this week. And Karen, did you want to add anything to that?
No, I think you did a good job. It's going to be interesting to see how, the various competencies and knowledge bases that each of the projects provide, and whether we're really through multiple projects developing robust abilities for people to learn about and become able to address these issues that we talk about every week on the call.
So that's one thing. And then the following Friday, I'm going to be attending the Sea Level Rise Summit in Boca Raton, Florida. And this is Jeff Ryan, who is the PI of the CSAP that is addressing coastlines and sea level rise in Florida in the Caribbean, is part of this group. But I'm going to be, it's going to be a session around education, and it's been kind of interesting. We had a teleconference with the presenters, which are from Florida, and are talking about their various individual regional efforts. And then I'm going to finish up with a discussion around CLEAN and the Climate Literacy Network. And one of the things that was kind of nice is originally I thought they wanted me to really just present CLEAN and the resources, but what they really were excited about was hearing about how the Climate Literacy Network works. And to potentially use that model for some of their regional networks. So I'll be doing that in a week from Friday. Great. Are there other announcements? Okay, well, if not, then we'll move on to our presentation for today. We have Dr. Howard Walters, who's an associate professor of research and learning sciences at Ashland University. And he also is a research fellow at the College of Exploration, which is where Scott Carley is from. And he is involved as the evaluator for the Great Lakes Climate Change and Education Systemic Network. And so he's going to talk to us today about that network. So the slides were available on the website. And Howard, I will turn it over to you.
I am very pleased to be here today, and in the Great Lakes Regional Partnership, certainly appreciate your invitation and an opportunity to talk about what we have done through Phase 1. And of course, those of you following this process know that we are on the cusp of of the Phase 2 awards, which have not been made yet, but there is a set of projects that are being considered. We are fortunate to be one of those, and we I can talk a bit perhaps about Phase 2 should we be fortunate to receive that funding. So let me back up then into the Phase 1 and give you just a bit of history about it. You know that the National Science Foundation put a call for proposals out some time ago now. We're finishing up the second year of the award period, and so the RFP came out in that previous season. There was a group of us working here in the Great Lakes on another NSF project. We had some peripheral knowledge of each other, but were parts of different communities of practice, if you will. There were those of us, some of us, who had been very involved in the education networks in the region, or in the psych and social science communities here in the region. And there was another group of people involved who were part of geosciences and climate sciences working in the region. And we would periodically cross paths, but we had not formally tried to work together. And when the proposal for Phase 1 came out to look at climate change in a systemic way, we put a team together that represented the learning sciences, the earth science and climate science community, as well as those of us traditionally in the educational research community. We proposed for Phase 1, and were successful in getting that award. If you have the slides in front of you, we sort of boiled down a very large proposal into some very brief bullets, and I just talked through them with you a bit. The first slide, Phase 1 goals, we really worked off of three comprehensive goals for that Phase 1 award. First, we wanted to create and implement a regional strategic planning process using formal needs assessments for all of the stakeholders and professional populations across the region. And let me just talk about this for a second. It's very easy to put a phrase together such as the name of our project, the Great Lakes Climate Change Science and Education Systemic Network. All those words sound great together. But science and education historically have not networked together. These have been very different networks of professionals who've worked very hard and accomplished a lot. But the historic pattern is that scientists are sort of doing their own thing, and educators, even science educators, we work somewhat twice or thrice removed from where that science is taking place. And some of that reality has emerged out of the different funding streams, the different requirements for research and tenure within our respective disciplines. And so it's real easy to say that we're going to be a science and an education network in the singular, but we thought on the front end that to do that and to do it well, it was going to require a deep and authentic planning process that went all the way back to really ground zero and started over. What are these separate communities, and how do we build a single community that is comprised of both scientists and educators, and how do we get it to function together? And so a big part of our Phase 1 process was formally collecting a lot of data in a formal process using surveys and focus groups and workshops, both in a virtual platform and also in a face-to-face setting a number of times, working at professional conferences and in separate meetings that we convened to understand the needs of scientists and educators around the content of climate change and climate change science. And that was a time-consuming process. Ultimately, that strategic planning process, we collected formal data, needs assessment data, programming data, research needs data, and also we collected baseline content knowledge measures for how well do these different communities truly know the content of climate change and climate change science. And we collected information from about 1,500 people formally using surveys and interviews and focus groups and these kinds of processes, tests that we administered to six or seven different professional groups, which will show up in a next slide or two down the pike here. And so using all of that information, we went through an analysis process, a lot of discussions. We are finishing up a pair of white papers on the region now, a white paper that covers the science and the science research needs, a second white paper that covers education and STEM education needs, and then a synthesis document that pulls that together into a regional strategic plan to work with a single community of individuals who are concerned with climate change science. And so that was a lot of the background on that first goal, on that first goal slide. The second thing that we set out as a major goal was to build and test a regional networked community where we would use virtual communication techniques to pull in individuals and organizations who had not historically networked together in the Great Lakes region to build the capacity for doing a better job with STEM education around the climate change content in the region. And for the folks who are on the call and listening who don't have an immediate social and geographic grasp of our Great Lakes region, this region is home to 1/4 of the U.S. population, about 82 million people, and we are about 1,100 miles from edge to edge if we start in New York and go all the way across to Minnesota. And so we have 8 U.S. states, as well as Canada on our northern neighbor across this Great Lakes region. And so we have a lot of people. We have large urban population centers that are facing and sitting right on these Great Lakes. And we can, in your mind, you can just play across the map with Cleveland and Detroit and Chicago and Milwaukee and very large urban centers of population. And then from the environmental perspective, the Great Lakes have 10,000 miles of shoreline and are comprised of 20% of the world's freshwater in these lakes and in the basins. And so this is a very, very important place on planet Earth with lots and lots of people interacting together. And our goal was to find a way to get as many of the people who are making decisions, who are doing the research, who are leading education in the region, how do we get them together on one page? And we feel like just the size of our region, that page is going to have to be virtual. And so in our phase one, online workshops are not new, but the use of online platforms to build virtual communities is something that requires a good bit more work and a good bit more research and discussion. So in our process, and we can talk about that a little bit later, we applied the techniques of learning sciences to look at how social communities are formed in virtual spaces, how information is passed, how leadership emerges, how individuals who are a part of a group of people working socially online, how key individuals can serve as bridgers between groups that don't necessarily cross paths with each other. So we applied some very rigorous research methods to look at pathways through which social communities emerge, and the things we learned, we believe we can now harness to continue to expand this virtual platform, and for for future work, whether related to climate change science or other content areas we would be interested in. So that really was the work involved with phase one, and then for those two goals. The third and final goal was to lay the groundwork for science-based and scientist-driven product creation in the region. And again, this is something that we are now ready to go. We've done a little bit of piloting work to make sure our process is going to work. But this gets to the heart of what a single social networked community looks like, where scientists are creating knowledge, working with interpreters and educators and learning scientists to embed that content into products, piloting and testing those products to make sure that the design of whether it's an education program, an exhibit, or a graphic display at an informal science center or a museum or a zoo, to make sure that the design is robust psychologically and developmentally and educationally so that the science is, in fact, transmitted accurately. And a part of this work, linking back to our first goal in phase one, was to ascertain some baseline measurements on our communities of interest. What exactly do they understand about climate change science, and are there gaps in that understanding? And so that, in as succinct a way as possible, is the set of goals that we started out with. And I suppose this may be a spot I can solicit at this point if there's questions about the goal setting and the work that we did, or I can move on to the next slide with respect to our accomplishments and findings. But are there questions at this point?
I think it's clear, Howard.
Well, we have tried. Thank you for that compliment. When you try to communicate with very different professional communities who have different jargon that they have incorporated in their professional practices. And then when you bring those communities together, you very quickly learn that you will either collapse in flames when you try to communicate, or you're going to learn to speak clearly about what you're trying to do. And so we really have tried to boil things down to very, very simple terms to make sure we are talking effectively to multiple audiences at the same time. One of our projects that we just this past weekend piloted, one of our partners is the Knight Center for Environmental Journalism at Michigan State University. And we convened a full-day workshop this past Saturday at the Cleveland Science Center, where 50% of the participants were journalists from across the United States, and 50% of the participants were research scientists who work in climate change research areas. And it was almost funny at times. They took turns presenting to each other out of their respective communities of practice, and there was an awful lot of, hang on a second, can you explain what that word means? That happened across that day, and it was very illustrative for us all. It's very difficult to build a cross community single network and expect them to work together. And so I really appreciate what you guys are doing with this site, with this effort, because it's one of those successful network communities that has emerged. That it really has gone through the fire, if you will, in working the kinks out of what a complex network looks like. But, well, let's move on then to a slide. We'll go to the phase one accomplishments. And again, this has been boiled down quite a bit, but I'll just sort of expand on it some as we go through it. So phase one accomplishments slide, in the first bullet, we did implement regional surveys to capture baseline understanding of climate change science content among scientists, journalists, formal educators, and by that phrase I mean those educators who teach in the K-12 classroom, informal educators who are employed in science museums, zoos and aquariums, science centers, those kinds of places across the region. Community NGO educators, and we have groups of people in that audience who are, for example, interpreters in park systems for state or county or even national park communities in the region. We have educators or people who function as educators who are attached to places like soil and water districts or Department of Environmental Resources or conservation in the region. Next, we had university faculty who identify as science faculty primarily and whose work is to teach content that is associated to climate change in universities across the region. And then we also surveyed and interviewed select teacher education faculty across the region. That group particularly was very interesting for us. We have a group of almost 500 university professors in the region who are teacher educators. Their job is to create classroom teachers. They work in pre-service education licensure programs, and we were able to track down through a lot of just hard legwork this group of professors across the 8-state region because we know from some of the research we've looked at that in these science methods classes, there is an attempt to get science lesson plans into the hands of these pre-service teachers. And we know from a couple of studies that if you get good quality science curriculum to pre-service teachers in science methods classes, when they are young school teachers out in practice, they are highly likely to go back to the shelf of material that they left college with and lean into that. And for that reason, we viewed that as a very critical audience for our potential work as if we move on into phase two. And so we did very complex surveys with all of those audiences, and we captured three tiers of information. The first tier of information was a set of validated items and very reliable items that were designed to test the content knowledge for climate change and climate change science so that we could do comparative work across each of these populations. You know, who knows the science best? Who knows the science least? And that's a very generalized statement, obviously working within the survey samples and that sort of thing. But we did have a survey sample size altogether of a bit more than 1,000 individuals who filled out these surveys. And it was, as perhaps you would intuit, our K-12 classroom teachers were the ones who had the lowest scores in terms of their basic understanding of climate change science and climate change. The highest scores, as we would hope and expect, were our scientists. The journalist scores actually were somewhat a little higher than our formal educators. Our sense is that the journalists we surveyed had a unique perspective and background preparation for climate change science, working with the Society for Environmental Journalism in the country. That our sample size included a fairly large number of journalists who focus on environmental science issues, and so they do have a bit of an advantage in terms of answering the questions because of their background research. Informal educators fell quite a bit higher in their raw scores than the K-12 classroom teachers, and so that was something we viewed as a positive finding. But there was quite a substantial gap between where the scientists' content knowledge is and where our education community is located in terms of their content knowledge. And so we see in that gap that exists, a tremendous need to find a way to link what the scientists know to what the educators know in a way that's more transformational. We have educators who tell us that the primary source of content knowledge that they have is either in news broadcasts or reading magazine articles or in discussing the content with colleagues. We don't find strong bridges in our data between these formal and informal educators and the scientists who are creating the content knowledge. And so while we know of some very successful models and networks that are in place and have been in place in the Great Lakes region for some time, the issue is one of scalability. And we all know that that is the persistent problem. If we look at applying for workshop money, for example, or doing workshops for classroom teachers, we may find, if we looked across the entire Great Lakes region, that there's federal money to support workshops in the summertime for classroom teachers. That money is there. But if you look at the number of slots for teachers in all of those workshops combined, you would find it's only a few hundred teachers at most who have access to those types of workshop models in the summertime in the Great Lakes region. Well, you know, we have 110,000 school teachers just in the state of Ohio alone. The workshops that are available are not even a fraction of what's necessary to bridge this gap between scientists and the classrooms. And so we're looking at vectors to move that knowledge that would be of greater leveraging capacity. And so we are looking at the use of the virtual platform to link scientists with the people like the teacher education faculty, the faculty who provide the coursework for science and museum educators. So by moving up that, if you can sort of envision that as a pyramid, by moving up so that we can focus our work between the scientists and the people who create the educators, we think we can see a broader impact on more educators over time. So we're trying to be a bit systemic about where we are focusing, and we're finding in the survey data and the research that we've done that there are data that justify that decision. The content knowledge gaps, for example, the willingness of teacher educators and university faculty to be more involved in the movement of climate change science information into their practice. So the data are proving helpful to us, and are, as we said, they are going into this strategic planning process so that initial efforts, whoever takes the initial effort, whether it's our team and our project or other networks that see these data ultimately when we start releasing the papers later this summer, the support for these kinds of approaches will be there, and we're hoping that these results can be informative for the broader groups that are out here in our region and in the nation practicing. So that's a part of our accomplishment. Second bullet there, we did in fact create and test a virtual platform that directly linked research scientists to the social communities. One of our major partners, the College of Exploration, Peter Tudenham and Tina Bishop, have worked with that organization for quite a long time now, 20 years actually, I think this last year. And they were able to create and implement a virtual video-based workshop where we worked with a scientist, Don Scavia in Michigan, who's done a great deal of work on climate change science, they were able to prepare a video lecture, use that as the core of a virtual workshop for several hundred individuals from across these different social communities, and while the workshop was going on, working behind the scenes, we had some education scientists, some learning scientists, a psychologist who were working map and evaluate the social connections that were created inside that learning platform, inside that virtual platform. And so using cluster analysis techniques, we were in fact able to measure a statistically significant increase in the strength and functionality of a social network using a virtual platform. And so we've not released the data on that yet. As you would understand, our science team is working toward published manuscripts, and so the data will emerge from the project, but we are very excited to see that there are parts of the design that are rigorous when they are subjected to psychometric testing and evaluation. And so we've settled on a model that has come through that piloting process, and that's the model we've moved on in some. That's part of our phase two proposal, is to take this model that's now been tested, to take this initial social network that has emerged, that we have been able to build in phase one, and then to use that network to the ends of moving climate science, climate change science, more quickly from the laboratory out into these areas and places where educators are created. And so that was a very exciting success for us in that phase one effort, was to see that kind of research data emerge from the use of that virtual platform. And again, if we're going to truly be regional, and as NSF has said, they want projects that can transform a community of practice, well, the area we're trying to target is very, very large and involves many, many people. And so just from a cost-benefit analysis, we're not going to be able to do that face-to-face. We're going to have to use emerging social networks and communication methodologies to arrange for that knowledge transfer to occur virtually.
Howard?
Yes?
Can you take just three sentences to give us some idea of what you mean by when you say you develop these social networks? Just give us a clue about what sorts of mechanisms you used and how you enabled people to interact.
Sure. The measure, I guess the interaction system is somewhat intuitive for you. When people are in a room taking a class, let's start with that as a metaphor. So you have a scientist in the front of a room giving a lecture. You have groups of people who are sitting in the room listening to the lecture. All right. In some education designs, when the lecture is finished, the group of people in the room are encouraged to get in small groups for further study, or to get in small groups to discuss the content, to ask questions of the speaker, to ask questions of each other. All of these kinds of pedagogical practices that we know as researchers enhance the learning that goes on in that lecture environment. All right, so with that picture in mind, translate that into an online virtual space where the speaker is in one location, where every member of the class is distributed across the country or the world. We have had people from as many as 40 different countries in some of these online discussion communities. But where the same pedagogical techniques are brought to bear, people can group themselves for discussion. People can ask the speaker questions. People can ask each other questions. There is evidence that this is not a set of isolated individuals just listening and watching, but there is social interaction that is occurring and emerging. And so there are research questions that should appropriately be asked about that virtual site. What is the nature and complexity of the learning? How accurate is the content knowledge preserved when it is transmitted across those virtual connections? Or do inaccuracies arise? And are there mechanisms to correct that movement of information for inaccuracies or mistakes or errors. I'm just being very basic here with how this sort of works. We enabled our learning scientists to, in a sense, lurk behind the scenes technologically so that they could monitor who was speaking to whom inside this virtual network. Which way were the questions moving? Who was asking a question of someone else, and what role did that person play? And when you allow this thing to run long enough and under observation, it is possible to establish a mathematic model to look at the strength of the connectivity between different individuals within that group. And then
once we
establish that mathematical strength and connectivity, it's possible then to do some predictive work and to do some modeling work. And we have had, our team has in fact walked through that kind of a system. And what we have observed is that there is in fact emergent leadership in virtual communities, for example. We do see individuals who emerge from this disassociated group of individuals who move into leadership roles that we've, one of our scientists, Ken Frank at Michigan State University, who's published extensively in this area, and Ken's the lead on this research. Ken has established that there are groups of people he has called bridging people who have emerged, who assume leadership in that social community, that draw clusters of individuals into smaller networks within the network. And in short, he's measuring an evolving and increasing complexity of the social network in the virtual space, just as we would observe in face-to-face interactive social communities out here in the real world.
Thanks.
And that tells us...
You don't need to go any further.
Okay,
I don't want to get you off track. We're almost out of time here, so I thank you. That's helpful.
Well, then, in terms of the remaining accomplishments, using all of that research, we have moved on to... synthesizing that into a needs assessment for the Great Lakes region. That needs assessment has been, at this point, interpreted into a proposal for a Phase 2 award, and it is pending at the National Science Foundation. It's finished review. We had a panel meeting last week with NSF to discuss the proposal, and we're waiting to see what's going to happen. In terms of the findings and the next steps, and these are next steps both for us, whether we are funded or not, we will continue to push in this direction. But then once the white papers and the publications begin to come out, we think there's data to support that these are next steps that are appropriate for other groups of people to consider. And those are two things that we have in the final slide. There is strong evidence for the need to build links between scientists and the education community to enhance the level of accurate science knowledge among educators and subsequently the lay public. At its base, we measured greater than a 20 percentage point gap in the accuracy of knowledge between scientists and science teachers. And that gap is a gap that we see in the movement of accurate science knowledge to our students, to the lay public. And that gap contributes to some serious economic consequences in our workforce. And the second thing, finally, there's strong evidence that a virtual social community using emergent communication technology can be a cost-effective vehicle to realize this first goal that I just read, and to implement learning science research on STEM content migration from laboratories to society. And that's where we find ourselves at the end of our Phase 1 award. We've got data to support doing both of these things. We've proposed that into Phase 2, and we'll wait and see what happens. So that's my talk. That's my presentation.
Great. Thank you so much, Howard. So are there other questions, either very detailed questions or more broad-based questions for Howard at this point from everyone?
Howard?
Yes.
Could you please share with us, I may have missed it, what gap did you find between scientists and lay people?
I don't have a figure for a measure on the general public. Some of our museum folks have done some measurement with the general public. I don't have that information right in front of me. We do have a baseline gap between scientists and classroom teachers that is about 24 percentage points on a very, very basic 12 question survey that we used, that where each of the 12 questions dealt with a piece of content knowledge associated to climate change science. And so that gap of about 24 percentage points between scientists and science educators is a concern.
And Howard, would these questions have been things that were linked to the climate literacy principles, for instance?
They were, actually. Let me see. I can pull the survey. I've got one laying here. I can give you a couple of the questions just as examples. And they were that's the wrong folder. Tier 1 questions. I thought I had them in front of me. For example, which of the following statements about global warming over the past 50 years most closely reflects your viewpoint? And there are four choices. Global warming over the past 50 years is mostly caused by human activities. Global warming is mostly caused by natural processes. Global warming has not really occurred over the past 50 years, or I do not know. Here's another question. Which description best represents your understanding of how the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has changed over the past 500 years? And the choices are no change, linear increase, linear decrease, exponential increase, exponential decrease, or I don't know. So it was a series of questions along those lines which were obtained through a great deal of research by another one of our partners at Michigan State. And they are somewhere in the background tied to some of the climate literacy standards and principles work.
Thank you very much. That addresses my question very well. Thank you.
Any other questions for Howard? Howard, I wonder whether you, I mean, in some ways, it's almost a summary question, but one of the major themes in the project is the immensity of trying to reach such a huge population, and what are the kinds of ways in which we would like to reach those folks. Now, where this project, and I guess I can say our project since I've been involved in it, we've really focused on using online media to do that. Maybe I can frame this question this way. Are there other ways that we could be approaching that? I guess that's a way of trying to create some discernment here, whether that is the best way to do that or whether there are other ways in which we can approach that. And I can say that because I know a number of the other CSEP 1 projects have used other kinds of mechanisms. They have not used online technologies. They've really used the workshop, the face-to-face meetings, and done a huge number of those kinds of things. What's your sense of the sort of relative merits of those two approaches?
I answer as a person who's been involved in teacher ed and in science education for 25 years, Scott. It's those are effective. You know, a face-to-face workshop is highly effective. It does something. I've just returned, my colleague Tina Bishop at the College of Exploration, she and I evaluate another project for the International Ocean Drilling Program, and I was just on ship with on the Joides Resolution down in the Southern Caribbean, where we had a group of teachers and informal educators on a ship for a while. very effective, dramatically effective programs when you can put teachers on ships like that. The reality is you can only put 10 teachers on that ship,
right?
And it costs a good bit of money to do that. I think we need programs that are face-to-face. We do need to put teachers on ships, but we also need to be aware of the critical time problem we're working with and issues of transformation and principles of transformation when we want to work with large social systems. The state of Ohio hires 10,000 new teachers every year.
Whoa.
Right? And that's just the state of Ohio. Now, we are one of the largest. I think we're the ninth largest state now, and so we have a large program, but we're not by any sense the largest. We could spend decades or even centuries trying to rotate that one single cohort of teachers into a face-to-face workshop or putting them on a ship, and they would absolutely benefit and value when they do that. But we all know we don't have the money to do that, nor do we have the time to do that. And so we need some techniques that allow us to leverage our content knowledge, our expertise, and our capability. We're trying to tackle leveraging in two ways. We have not proposed to do workshops for groups of teachers. We are not proposing to do workshops with high-ability kids in high school. Those are meritorious activities, and I have some projects where I do workshops with a dozen teachers at a time. I'm doing a workshop here on campus next week on short cycle assessment and statistical analysis with a group of 10 classroom teachers for a week, and we will have a good time, and they will learn. But I'm not going to get that content out to 100,000 teachers next week. I'm going to be working with 10. Mm-hmm. And so we need a mix, and so we're going to try to target using a virtual communication system a much larger number of people. But a second piece here, we're trying to target people who are change agents, right?
Right.
We want to work with not classroom teachers. We want to work with the teacher education faculty who create classroom teachers. Right? Now, I was a second grade school teacher. I love school teachers, and I have oriented my life around trying to help school teachers. But somebody has got to work at that macro level, and some other folks need to work at the micro level. If we can target these 500 professors across these eight states who year in and year out are teaching science methods classes to groups of 25 or 30 young people who are going to be school teachers someday, right? And if we can link science presentations from real scientists so that we teach these young people to get used to listening to a research scientist talk about climate change, and we hand them other people's lesson plans and activities. We're not creating lesson plans and activities, by the way. We're hoping to build partnerships and network with people like who are sitting on this phone call today. We are looking at the strength of the network, the social community, working with transformation agents, and working directly with the scientists to put all of that together in one box. And Scott, I hope I've spoken to what you were sort of getting at.
Absolutely. That's great.
Right. And here's just another thought thrown in is your young people, that's one theory of change is getting the pre-service teachers, bringing them up to speed on this knowledge, and they're going to go out there. But they're also going to have mentor teachers and leaders that are within the existing school system. So it would be nice to target the professional development of those teachers that are already out there in the trenches. And if you can target the leaders the way that you are doing, they can do face-to-face within their own learning communities, even though they may be coming up to speed via online stuff.
I agree completely. I failed to mention, if we are funded, we do have connections that we have established with Cleveland Metropolitan School System and also with Detroit. Two, as you all know, two very problematic urban school systems that need a lot of support and help. And yet they have some marvelous teachers and leaders on the ground in those communities who are willing to look at some of these areas of science. So absolutely, that is true. And I like the comment from the person that just asked that question, the comment that this is one theory of change. That is a marvelous phrase, and it's absolutely correct. There are a number of theories of change that we need to pursue simultaneously. I applaud those individuals who are working with the revised National Science Education Standards, for example, who are trying to get climate change science, to get ocean science into those national standards. That is another expression of a theory of change that says that the basic written curriculum can be framed to enhance the use of certain sciences, which is absolutely wonderful. Another theory of change is the idea of political action, and we have, while some of us are working in situations where we cannot lobby, we cannot engage in politics, we do have partners who don't have those kinds of obstructions professionally. And yet another theory of change is to be actively political about this and to work through community change and community activism and organization to seek from the grassroots level things like sustainable development. And in my own town, we have a wonderful new food cooperative on the weekend called Local Roots. And it's a place where local small farmers can bring organic produce and organic meat, and they can find a supportive market to share and to sell these things. And those are the kinds of grassroots efforts that we also need to see as yet another theory of change. And so I love it when I hear somebody use that phrase, because it reminds us that there's a lot of good people doing good things in a lot of communities of practice out there. And we all need to be better about helping those colleagues be visible when we can. That's why I so appreciate being invited to come onto this phone call today, because you guys have done that for us.
You know, it's really fascinating to imagine creating a visual map that shows the interlinkages of functioning at different levels.
Mm-hmm.
So fantasize about that, everybody.
Yeah. It's amazing work. And you can do a literature review and look for Ken Frank. He's a wonderful young researcher who's already done some marvelous things, and he is at Michigan State University. There's some great papers out there that you can look at.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? We're almost at the top of the hour. Well, Howard, thanks so much for this presentation. It's actually really fun for me to hear it, because you have a very different perspective on the project than I have, and that's really great to hear it. So thanks again for doing this, and I certainly invite folks to contact Howard if you have any more questions around what we're doing in the Great Lakes, and that's...
Absolutely. Absolutely. You guys can get my email from Scott and from that team, and we'll be glad to talk to anybody individually after the fact. So, again, thank you for the invite, Scott.
You're very welcome. Thank you again, Howard.
Okay, thank you.
Just as a final announcement, I just want to let everyone know that Steve Snyder is going to talk next week from the Franklin Institute, and he's talking about the Urban Climate Education Partnership, I think is what they call themselves. So Steve is probably going to be our last speaker, at least at this set of presentations. So that's next week on the 19th, and I hope you all can join us. And we should have the recording of this presentation up hopefully by the end of the day, too, if you want to mention it to other folks to listen.
This is Martha. I'm going to Rio Plus 20. Is anybody else going to be there?
Oh, I'd love to go.
Hi.
So, Martha, we're going to have to ask you to do a presentation for us, at least, if not formally, informally, and tell us how that has gone, especially with, you know, right on the ground.
Yeah, that'll be great. And you can follow on CSR Wire. We have a column running on that.
So. Absolutely. That's a great idea. We should put that out onto the network, too, so that we can track your blog. Excellent.
Hey,
any
Bob,
other comments before we wrap?
I have a question.
Sure, please.
What kind of timeline is the Climate Literacy Network on? How long do we all get to keep going like this?
Well, until we completely run out of money. We're actually talking about that. So far, we're good. Probably for another little while. So, but we'll see what happens. We're actually exploring keeping a little bit of funding so we can keep going. So, yeah, we're still alive.
Still alive, still kicking, and still bringing in good speakers. Thank you so
much.
Yeah,
and it's just a compliment to all of us because we really feel like it's important that we all get together like this every week, whether it's for a formal presentation informal discussion, or to do what we've done over the last couple of weeks to be able to do a review of the next generation science standards. So that all that work is really important. So I'm glad we can do this.
Likewise. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks to everyone. I think we're done. It's the top of the hour.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Talk to you next week. Bye now.
Bye.